Welcome to Global Crossings, a podcast produced by the Global Leadership Institute at Boston College. Ms. Frances Fitzgerald is an Irish MEP from Dublin and host of the podcast, The European Lens. She joins Dr. Robert Morrow, Executive Director of the Global Leadership Institute, to discuss Ireland's role in the European Union, the European Union's role in Ireland, and global leadership. We learn about her view of the Irish public's relationships with the European Union and how it has changed or not through the Brexit process. Discussion investigates the role of the European Union in combating COVID-19, promoting public welfare, enhancing diversity and inclusion, and encouraging economic development, as well as sustainable trade. Opening remarks provided by Dr. Alicia Moore, Consul General of Ireland to New England. Enjoy the podcast, adapted from a previously recorded webinar on Monday, March 1st, 2021.
Our guest today is Frances Fitzgerald. She's now a member of the European Parliament, but she was a minister in government for a number of years, held a number of positions. You may remember her from her role as Tánaiste and other jobs within the Irish government. But today's discussion is Ireland and global leadership through a European lens. Before we engage with Frances Fitzgerald, we will first welcome Dr. Alicia Moore, the Consul General here in Boston. And Alicia, over to you.
Bob, lovely to see you again on this rainy Boston afternoon. I'm delighted to be partnering with you once again at the Global Leadership Institute in Boston College to continue this conversation, these virtual fireside chats. I know everybody is reflecting at the moment that it's been, you know, nigh on a year since we all got hit with the pandemic and transitioned to this virtual world, but I have to say, I personally am really pleased that working with Boston College, we have been able to continue those engagements and continue a series of really interesting conversations. And I think today's conversation is going to be offering a slightly different and a very interesting perspective because, as you said, Frances Fitzgerald, MEP, is not only a very experienced Irish political leader, having occupied, as you said, the office of Tánaiste or Deputy Prime Minister and such important posts as Minister for Justice and Equality, the Minister for Business and Jobs. She's also, as you mentioned, since 2019, she's been a member of the European Parliament for Dublin. And so now her work has a distinctly European perspective. And Ireland, as a member of the EU, for us, the future of the EU and developments in the EU are of the utmost importance for Ireland, politically, economically, and in our day-to-day lives. And of course, as well, Ireland's relationship with the US is really important for us politically and economically. So I think it will be very interesting to hear from our speaker today, her thoughts on those linkages, that transatlantic relationship between the US and Ireland, but also between the US and the EU, what that means for Ireland and where that's going in the future. So thank you once again for hosting what I know is going to be a really interesting discussion.
Thank you, Alicia. I appreciate your support and help and partnership on this program. It's been, as I said, it's been exciting. A couple of months working on this project, and I'm particularly enthusiastic about welcoming Frances Fitzgerald to the conversation today. As Alicia has already told us, Frances is Tánaiste, Deputy Prime Minister, a three-time minister in the Irish government, and you joined the European Parliament in 2019 after you left government, and but before that, you were in local government, and in fact, you were a community leader. You worked at National Women's Council of Ireland, and you've held many different leadership positions across a number of different electoral bodies and different types of organizations representing people in different ways. I mean, you had a very long career, and I did watch a TEDx talk by you in preparation for this, where when you were introducing yourself, you talked about winning some elections and losing some elections, and the natural kind of thing that every politician goes through. I mean, what keeps you motivated and keeps you coming back and looking, you know, for those leadership opportunities. Surely there are opportunities for you to leave politics by now, but you've remained. So maybe you could talk to our audience, just, you know, what motivates you?
Well, I love the work. I really enjoy the work of being a politician. I started off doing a social science degree in Dublin, in University College Dublin. And by the way, hello to everybody. It's great to be connecting back with Boston, Robert, and thank you for the opportunity and also for our Consul General to be supporting these kind of events. I've great memories of trips to Boston College and to Boston. So, I mean, what keeps me motivated, I guess, is that I really do enjoy the work. I like influencing. I like leading change. I started off, as I began to say there, as a social worker. I did a basic social science degree in Dublin, and then I went to the London School of Economics and did a master's. My master's was in school truancy, so I was very interested in non-attendance at school and the problems that families had. And I worked for 20 years as a social worker. I never thought I'd be a politician, you know. So when I hear a young girl saying, well, you know, when did you decide, or young guys saying to me, well, when did you decide you wanted to be a politician? I never, you know, decided early on that this was a, you know, a goal that I had. And I'm a great believer in saying to people, do what you enjoy. And it's amazing how something that you did earlier in your life, you know, leads in and influences and informs work later on. So that when I was doing my social work or my free legal aid or mediation courses or working and understanding vulnerable families, did I ever think I would be Minister for Children, the first Minister for Children in Ireland, and that I would be involved in making sure the Irish Constitution reflected children's needs? No, I didn't. Or did I know that they would influence me as Minister for Justice when I, you know, worked on marriage equality, or I worked on a child and family relationship bill that reflected the modern Irish family? I didn't. I really did what I enjoyed in social work. And then I was very interested in equality issues. And I'll finish by saying, when my first son was born in London, I got involved in women's role, if you like, and voice in maternity hospitals and an organization called the National Childbirth Trust. And then when I came back to Ireland, I worked on equality issues, and I had great, actually, American women coming over to speak to us. I was just thinking today of Pat Schroeder and Geraldine Ferraro and Bella Abzug. We had them all coming over here, informing us and really being very important mentors to many of us with the national conferences we ran. So, you know, it's something that my career evolved. And people now will often have, you know, two or three or four careers. So I think it's really to do what you enjoy. And I think I've been driven by my values of equality and inclusivity and diversity. And that comes from family influences, but also from, you know, my education, really.
That's very interesting. And during that long career and kind of returning to the thing that you loved and your desire to kind of help, I mean, you might have amassed kind of more experience than any other elected official in Ireland. I didn't fully realize, I think, until I began to do the research here, how kind of many important junctures you kind of were instrumental in. You were the founding, or we'll call you the founding Minister for Children and Youth Affairs. And there you led a referendum. You led a second referendum as Minister for Justice on the Marriage Equality Act. I mean, you know, and I think in that YouTube video, you also discussed that the marriage equality referendum as being one of the most valuable things that you have done, you know, as a political leader for yourself. I mean, can you talk about that time? I mean, you know, referendums are tricky. Not everyone is successful. You don't know which way they're going to go. We learned that with Brexit. You know, I mean, how nervous were you going into those referendums, or were you confident based on kind of the experience that you had that this is something you should do and that will be successful?
Well, look, it was a great honor to be a minister for that period of 7 years, and I was very fortunate. One of the things we had for the first 5 years was a majority government, and I can recommend it. It's great compared to coalitions and minority governments and trying to get those agreement across parties. You know, we really were able to lead, I believe, at that time. There was great support in the country for us, but it was an incredibly difficult time. I was making budget cuts I really didn't want to make to very important areas in order to see the country through the financial crisis. But we were committed as governments to these referendums. And of course, we do know, Robert, as you said, that people often in referendums answer a different question to the one they were asked. And that's always a risk. And both of those referendums, probably the children's, we got a lower turnout than we thought. We decided to have the vote on a Saturday instead of during the week like we normally do. People were very busy on Saturday. Some people forgot to vote, no question. And then we had a constitutional challenge about some information that we had published. So it was nerve-wracking right to the very end. But I remember the moment when the Supreme Court cleared it all. And I knew that what we had put to the people about listening to children's voices and protecting children and seeing children in their own right, that had gone through. It was an absolutely fantastic feeling. I worked very closely, of course, with a lot of people, with NGOs, with the Attorney General, who was superb, with a good team in government who were committed to it, and cross-party consensus on it actually as well. And likewise with marriage equality, it was kind of a moment whose time had come, but I think it still took the country by surprise. And we had a citizens' assembly beforehand, and I think the citizens' assembly almost shocked a lot of people because it was so progressive about what it said. And then we became the first country by referendum to have marriage equality. And again, I remember that moment when I completed the legislation in the Senate, and it was just the most, marvelous feeling, because you just felt you knew the difference it made to people's lives. I mean, this was very real for people who'd been excluded. And during the campaign, I remember being in a march once it was a marriage for marriage equality. And I remember looking at the faces, and they were so full of hope. And I remember meeting, older men and women, and you knew how much this meant to them. So what a privilege to have been in a government and to be part of this campaign. And I suppose one of my themes in government, and one of the things I feel very much about politicians, is you're at your best if you're bridge building with other groups. You can't do it on your own. Nobody does. It's always about that engagement with the NGOs and with different people, if you want to really make a difference.
My video is, I'm on a different computer today. My video occasionally, I'm just going to stop and restart it. A couple of questions have come in. The questions already come in, and we'll return to it on Brexit. But if you do have a question, please send it over in the Q&A or the chat function, and we'll get it on to Francis. You talked about the period of change and that led up to the referendum. How, in your mind, has Ireland changed because of the referendum since then? I mean, have you noticed as a political leader, the way political conversations are had about identity, has that changed? Or have you seen other kinds of changes? I mean, what kind of things has that referendum brought for Ireland?
I think reputationally, it's been very important for Ireland internationally. I think our inclusivity, I mean, it's a marker of inclusivity, let's face it. And even if you look at the economics, you look at companies coming to Dublin, and of course, pre-COVID, we're now in the COVID situation, which is totally different. But one of the things that's very clear is that cities that are inclusive, countries that are inclusive, there is a link to economic development. And in terms of, retaining talent and attracting talent for companies and businesses, it's very clear that if you have an inclusive culture, as we have, you see that all around Ireland, but you see it in Dublin, you see it in all our cities, in Galway and Cork, and you see the sort of economic success that we've had. I think it's connected in, actually. It is one of the features that are very attractive about Ireland. So it has made a difference, I think, economically, reputationally, and I think we're proud ourselves in a very good way. I think we're proud that we were able to do this for people. And as always, it was the individual stories that made a difference. It was the grandmothers, it was the mothers, it was the sibs, it was the parents of young people who they knew were excluded. And, you know, we have a very bad history on lots of these issues, a very controlling sort of country, a hierarchical in the past. And I think, you know, it is one of a number of factors. It's not the only one. Obviously, you know, the country has undergone huge economic and social change. And it's a different country now, but of course, in a very challenging period at present with COVID.
Yeah, it's interesting that you should bring up COVID, especially there at the end and talking about inclusivity. You know, as your role in the parliament, you've actually linked the two, and you said at one point that this is an opportunity to change the economy and to change society for, you know, to encourage greater inclusivity, and especially on gender. And you were specifically referring to, you know, providing for opportunities, you know, for women and minority communities to kind of enter STEM fields or AI or digital finance. I mean, what are some things that you are doing as an MEP to sort of help encourage that transition in Europe and then help Europe encourage that transition in Ireland?
Well, before COVID, we were talking in Europe, and I'm always hugely impressed with the European vision, the European agenda. And Ursula von der Leyen, who's the president of the Commission, she said, you know, we want to be green, we want to be digital, we want to be equal. And I add in caring, because care has become such an issue. Who cares for people during the COVID pandemic? And that was the vision, you know, before COVID. Now it's about the COVID recovery. Plus, we have to recover into a green Europe, a digital Europe, a Europe that's equal and inclusive and that really looks at the care issues. And that's the agenda now. And, you know, President Joe Biden has a great phrase, which I really love, which is, you know, don't tell me what your values are. Show me your money and where you put it, and then I'll tell you what your values are. And so when we come to the recovery from COVID, we have to make sure that it's a recovery that takes account of the differential impact of COVID. We're going to have to put a lot of money, and the EU has put 1.8 trillion aside. It's raised its own Eurobonds for the first time very successfully. It was accused of being slow during the financial crisis. In fact, all of the changes and reforms we did during the financial crisis meant that the EU responded really effectively from a financial point of view to this crisis. And of course, the EU was founded in a crisis. It was the World War. And, you know, coming together, we can never have a war like that again, was the driving force, bringing us together as an economic force. So COVID, it's very important to say, has had a differential impact. Everyone is affected by it. More men are dying, more older men are dying. But the socioeconomic impact is very profound when it comes to women. Women's jobs are more precarious. They're often on the front line of healthcare. They are very exposed during COVID. We have, for example, simple things like research papers. We have a reduction in the number of research papers coming from women. We have more women opting out of the workforce. You have the, as always, that combination of, you know, work and childcare and family life. You have the pressures of that falling more on women, and you have this scourge, this dreadful increase in domestic violence right across Europe. You know, whatever it is about our society still, that the power imbalances, you know, express themselves through domestic violence. And so we have to, if you want to recover, you have to understand the differential impact. And of course, we also have to do much work to deal with the youth unemployment we have, to reskill people. And of course, working from home isn't an excuse for a lack of childcare, but working from home has great advantages, but we want to make sure that it really works well for people. So I think, you know, COVID recovery is very challenging in across Europe, where many countries, Robert, are still in lockdown. So we're in a very serious situation at the moment, and dreadful for our SMEs and businesses, and they will need incredible support. They're getting support during COVID, but the recovery is going to be so challenging, and it's going to be difficult for some businesses to survive.
it certainly is a challenging time. You can see it here in the States as well, many places closing and perhaps not to reopen because of the crisis and with lack of people going out. And some of these problems, I think, you know, that you highlighted are in some ways universal, at least to the fully developed economies, and with questions around childcare and who is working in essential jobs and who isn't. You know, you're in Dublin right now. Most of the EU institutions are in Brussels or Strasbourg or, you know, wherever they happen to be. You know, how are you able to maintain a connection with your colleagues, not only, you know, in EPP or, you know, in the Parliament more generally as well? And is that creating differences of opinion about how things go forward, or is kind of being close to your constituency in Ireland kind of having you know, a benefit that outweighs that kind of separation you're experiencing from your colleagues in the Parliament or the EPP?
I think if anything, many of us are working harder. I mean, we're doing a huge amount of, you know, this, just the connectivity issues are just enormous. I mean, it's extraordinary the opportunities that are there to work remotely. You know, we've done so many webinars, both in Ireland and in Europe. I can speak in the plenary session in Brussels. We can do all our committee work. I'm in touch with my group, which is 187 members. We're meeting all of the time in, you know, variations and various groups. We have our committee work that's going on. It's very intense. So you feel very connected in with all of your colleagues. Now, it's different, of course, to face-to-face meetings and all of the networking that goes on, and the lobbyists are online to us. They're not coming in to see us and talk to us. But, you know, I've just come off a webinar with the High Representative, Joseph Borrell, speaking on disinformation and our relationship with Russia and China. And, you know, quite a number of my colleagues were on that as well, and colleagues from other parties. So it is, I think we've learned, you know, we often thought it would take 10 years, maybe 5 to 10 years, to get to the point we're all at now in terms of remote working. And it is going to change how we work in the future. It can be very efficient. It's not the same. I'm so glad I saw the atmosphere of the European Parliament before this lockdown, because it was and is fantastic. I mean, to see 27 member states working together cooperatively, sometimes very slowly, Robert, I have to say, there's an incredible amount of consultation. I had a report going through the Parliament recently, it took me a year, but you know, it was well worth it. And I have got, even though I worked as a minister in Europe, when you're a member of Parliament, working with members from Poland and from, you know, all of the other countries, from Hungary, from, you know, Belgium, France, Spain, you get a real understanding of the differences, I have to say, East-West, and within cultures, even in relation to something that I see as very universal, like equality, or the role of business, you know, due diligence, where should you draw the line? What are the demands we should put in business? You'll see quite big differences, for example, between the Nordics and some other countries. I'm very disappointed in some of what I'm seeing in Eastern Europe in relation to equality. There's some very, very, I have to say, it's very regressive in terms of, it's quite a backlash to equality in a number of member states. And that's very disappointing. And I've been somewhat shocked by that. But you get this incredible, you know, face-to-face contact that gives you this great insight into the project that is the EU. And I think it's why, you know, Irish people are hugely supportive of the EU. And we've had incredible support. The Consul General in Boston, I'd say, would say to you, you know, Ireland has had the most amazing support from the other member states, because Brexit was more challenging, is more challenging for Ireland than for anywhere else. And I think that we've had extraordinary support for the Good Friday Agreement to ensure this continued peace and that we don't have a border. And Brexit has been a total shock to the EU. Nobody expected it to go through. There's nothing good about Brexit for the EU or for Ireland, actually. I'm not even sure for the UK there is, but they would differ on that, and they have a right to make that decision.
There's a lot in there. And so maybe we'll cut into a couple of the issues you raised. You talk about some of the broad differences across Europe between the Nordics and some of the other states. We know about some of the debates around gender and identity that are coming out of Eastern Europe and the way your other European nations are dealing with this. You know, when it gets into the specifics about advantages and competition between states, and how does that work itself out in the parliament? I mean, one area that I think a lot of people here in the US are particularly curious about is the fallout from Brexit and the way financial service industry has dispersed a little bit across Europe. Some of it has gone to Dublin, but some of it has gone to other cities. I mean, is there ever a tension in the parliament around those national interests and very specific national interests around jobs and wealth growth and the European interest?
Yes, I mean, I think you do see that. Obviously, we're in competition with Luxembourg, with Frankfurt, with Berlin when it comes to financial services. Post-Brexit, Ireland has done very well on financial services. We're seen as a center of, you know, real expertise. I mean, the way you'll find it in relation to Ireland is that it'll be a criticism of our tax policy, of our corporate tax. And of course, that's decided by unanimity in the parliament. You will find people wanting to change tax rules by a simple majority. It's not going to happen. We won't agree to that. And we go with the OECD approach, you know, to tax. But that's where you'd see some of the tension, all right. And of course, I mean, as Minister for Business and doing trade missions abroad, you certainly see the tensions. I mean, we're fighting, you know, we'll fight Scotland and Wales and Germany or wherever. You're always out there. And we've been incredibly successful. I mean, we had the fastest growing economy in Europe for, I think it was 5 years, maybe more in a row recently. So, I mean, we've got quite skilled at the business of attracting investment. We're very proud of our relationship with America and American firms here who employ so many people. And the Irish, you know, diaspora is so brilliant at connecting in with Ireland. And we really value that relationship. But equally, one of the things we're having to do now, Robert, is we're having to diversify because we are so dependent for our trade on the UK, particularly our food and agriculture. And one of the things our small firms are going to have to do, first of all, they have to become more digital. The statistics across Europe on small business and digital are really disappointing. They're very low. And we have to diversify into markets other than the UK. And we now have less reliance. We are doing that. But for if you think of a small firm having to do that and start supplying their goods to, you know, Sweden or to Belgium or France, you know, understanding that market and how different it is, this is very challenging. And but we're doing it. We have to do it post-Brexit because there's too much disruption to our UK trade.
There is a question on Brexit that's come in since you brought it up. We might as well go ahead and address it. You know, when the questioner would like to know when we can expect the UK and the EU to agree fully on trade guidelines for cross-border trade. Is there a timeline on those ongoing negotiations? And of course, we know that there's some backtracking on the Northern Ireland Protocol. I mean, what's your sense of how that's going to unfold from here on out?
Well, we will have a vote in the European Parliament, which is really the final stage, more or less the final stage in April. So, but it's all there in the detail of the protocol. We see the protocol as the solution. We don't see it as a problem. And of course, you know, people who have different views on Brexit, particularly in the North, have different views on the protocol as well. But to my mind, the protocol gives the very best opportunity to Northern Ireland to make the best of its links with the UK and the EU. But I accept that not every political party in the North sees it like that. We had quite a mishap, really, with Article 16 recently in the European Parliament, or in the European Commission, I should say. It was addressed within 3 hours, but the damage, you know, some damage was done. I would probably label it a very bad bureaucratic mistake, but a bad political mistake as well. It shouldn't have happened. Corrected very quickly. but really has upset so many people politically and created political tension. And as our Taoiseach said now, we want to dial down that tension. We really want to dial down that tension because, you know, it doesn't help the political situation to dial it up, that's for sure. It was very unfortunate, more than unfortunate, really deeply regrettable, I would say. And there have been teething problems. You know, it's one thing to say prepare for a whole new customs declaration situation. And, you know, we have free movement of goods. So we have to be careful on the island of Ireland that we are sticking with all of the rules of the EU from a standards point of view and so on, from a tracing and tracking. And really, people were not as prepared as they needed to be. And as long as the shelves of the supermarkets in Northern Ireland have any shortages, of course, people are going to be concerned. As long as trucks are delayed bringing in goods, of course, they'll be concerned. But I think with goodwill, there's a huge package of it's actually even difficult for me to explain how complicated the implementation package is. Enough to say there's 19 committees involved in this. There's an EU-UK parliamentary forum being established, and there's also a high-level council. And so, you know, every effort, it's very tight. There's an awful lot in it to make sure this works, but it's going to take time. So the answer to the question is, there is a process of implementation of the agreement that is going to take, we're going to be doing this for a long time. I mean, when a member state leaves the you know, the EU. Well, first of all, we're not used to it. Secondly, it's very complicated. It's harder. It may be as hard to leave as it is to join. And that's what we're working through.
Yeah, it's certainly very complicated, I think, this exit process. Do you think there are additional measures that should be taken above and beyond the protocol to facilitate the trade? Or Do you think that the protocol is enough? It requires, as you said, goodwill and, you know, a calmer kind of demeanor and language. Is that the solution, or are there actual kind of institutional or policy changes, do you think, that need to be made?
I don't think there are kind of institutional or policy changes, but I do think there are flexibilities that can be applied. So we have various timelines that are there. Now, with the COVID situation particularly, I think that some of those timelines are very short. You know, they're 3 months and 6 months. And we all know how the difficulties we're facing anyway because of COVID. You add Brexit into it. I think there is, you know, room for flexibility. But it means developing the relationship with the EU-UK. You know, it's in a different situation. We're in a different situation now. You're dealing with a government, obviously, in the UK, totally pro-Brexit. There's been a lot of tensions, and there's new relationship. A new relationship has to be forged, and there are going to be ups and downs. It's not going to happen overnight. You just have to really hope that it doesn't deteriorate and that we can build, you know, rather than disassemble any of the great work that has been done. I have to say, with the help of so many people from Boston and so many people from the United States, that piece that has been, you know, hard to get, that nothing disrupts that.
That's great. There is a question, another question about Brexit, this relating to the Good Friday Agreement. The viewer is asking or says, can you comment on how Brexit is affecting the access that people in Northern Ireland will have to the European Commission on Human Rights and the Court of Human Rights? They note that this is an important issue since the Northern Irish Bill of Rights promised in the Good Friday Agreement has not materialized. I'm not sure if you've given much thought to that particular challenge.
Yeah, well, I mean, it depends, I guess. I mean, the problem is institutionally, in terms of the UK's approach to the EU and the European Court of Justice and so on, and the human rights they should still be accessed to. I mean, I think that access will still be there. But I think everything has got more complicated because of the, you know, the complete ambivalence to European institutions from the UK side. But on the human rights and the access, my understanding is that will remain.
As you can see, the the audience here in Boston is very, very concerned about the effect of Brexit on Northern Ireland and the relationships there. And I have a feeling people are going to continue to follow this closely. So it'll be something that will be interesting for us to see as it develops. Maybe you could talk a little bit more about, you know, what the European Union can do in Ireland and for Ireland. I know you have an interest in sustainability, the circular economy, increasing renewable energy resources. At other times, you've also talked about the housing crisis. I mean, in what ways can, you know, the European Parliament help member states, you know, move towards a greener society, or enhance their ability to kind of generate a sustainable circular economy, or to, you know, to promote, you know, housing development, for instance. This is in part about some of those specific policies, this question, but also about kind of that relationship between a member state competency and an EU competency, and how that works itself out.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is something, I mean, we have a very sort of intricate relationship and very complex relationship with the EU, but the, you know, one has to say that the European investment in Ireland over, you know, the 47 years has been extraordinary and has totally helped Ireland develop as an economy, no question of it. And again, if you look at post-COVID, the kind of investment that's coming from the European Investment Bank, for example, for housing in Ireland and for social housing is extraordinary. And also for refurbishing old properties, all of that is being supported from Europe as well as by our own government. And when it comes to the circular economy, I mean, we have a huge opportunity now if we want to get to climate neutrality by, you know, the timeframes that we have. Absolutely, the circular economy. And I think this is very exciting, Robert. I don't think we've hardly begun on the journey, although it's very clear that the public, every survey tells us the public are very keen for us to do more and more of this. But if we are to achieve our climate neutrality target by 2050, we can't do that without transitioning to a full circular economy. And I think, you know, that is something that people are getting so used to. Like, and we have to look at design, we have to look at manufacturing, we have to look at consumption, repair, reuse, recycling, and bringing resources back into the economy. So there's huge work for businesses to do and suppliers, and looking at supply chains. I think the public really are very much with us on that. And the EU action plan is to reduce the EU's consumption footprint and double the EU's circular material use rate in the coming decade. And here's what's interesting about that. They say that we can actually create 700,000 jobs by doing that, so that there is huge opportunity in this green economy if we really begin to move more and more into it. And in my first year in the European Parliament, one of the things that I heard of again and again was sustainable finance. And now the bankers and the investors tell me there is more money than there are projects. So I think this brings us to the question of innovation and supporting innovation. And of course, the USA has been terrific on this. Europe less so. China is flying ahead on innovation and innovative products. So I think if you want to really get into the circular economy, we have to make sure that we're supporting innovation and having innovation hubs. And we've done a certain amount of that in Ireland. We have a new ministry here now for science and further education and research. We have a new innovation and research policy coming out. We've always tried to support that. And we've had huge successes, for example, in the west of Ireland and medical devices. We've become absolutely world experts on that. So this is what we have to do if that circular economy is to become a reality. Because if we're going to reuse products, obviously there's a whole lot of innovation involved, and replacing plastics and so on. So it's a very big challenge, but I think it's good to talk about the opportunity that's there as well with job creation if we get it right. So this is a very detailed plan that came out. I think we're all still getting to know it yet, but it's got targets and it's got, you know, various suggestions about for legislation and also for non-legislative measures to achieve this circular economy. I think myself at a very kind of individual level, people are getting very interested in this. You even see that kind of quote repair economy coming in, you know, instead of buying the shoes and not getting them sold again, which always took me by surprise, I have to say, you know, people would get their shoes resold. But that's just a tiny example. But it's kind of, and the whole attitude, I think, to fast fashion, you know, and people are interested in that, not, and also in the supply chains and human rights issues. So it all comes together, I think. And Europe is definitely, you know, the green agenda. And in our plan of working with the USA, climate change and the green economy is a big part of the cooperation in that transatlantic relationship. So I think we're all struggling a little bit with it and with the change that's involved. But it's great to see America rejoining the Paris Accord now and, you know, agreeing those goals once again. We're really delighted at a European level to see that as a huge change with the new presidency in America.
Yeah, it's certainly an interesting time in the United States politically as we go through our transitions. I mean, you raise a lot during your last answer or that I think will be familiar to people here in Boston. Certainly, you know, issues around innovation and success of the Irish economy and in innovating, especially in the tech sectors. You talked about medical devices or software development. You know, you are a member of the Economic and Monetary Affairs Committee, and that sounds like a mouthful. And I'm sure some of it is when you're talking about things like quantitative easing and other kind of mechanisms. It's a pretty big brief there. But some of the other work that you do there really does touch on some of that what we were just talking about in terms of innovation. One thing that you have taken a lead on is the digital operational resilience for the financial sector. And I think this is something that really resonates with people here in Boston because our financial tech sector is such a big one. Our cybersecurity sector here is a big one. We know it's important in Ireland. In that space, what are the opportunities for Europe and Ireland, you know, to innovate around this particular issue, ensuring digital financial resilience?
Well, first of all, obviously, the potential of this connectivity is just wonderful. I mean, right around the world. I mean, the digital connectivity, we've seen some of it with COVID, interestingly. I mean, we've seen changes in medicine and online consultation that really were people were just talking about before. We see it in education with distant learning and so on. In agriculture, smart agriculture, there are incredible opportunities with the connectivity, but there are, to look at some of the problems, we have big issues still around digital literacy. We have a gender gap as well in AI and research in that area and so on, which we really have to be very alert around right across Europe. We have that divide, which is extraordinary given the number of women who are, you know, going on to further education and so on. Then there's the question, this door of file you're talking about is the one about resilience. I mean, this is for the financial sector. This is to make sure that we have the processes in place that mean that working digitally is secure across the financial sector. And we're working very closely with business at the moment. And it also particularly impacts on global firms because, you know, if they have third-party providers outside, for example, the EU, what obligations do we put on those providers? And how do we make sure there's a resilience and a safety there? And we have to be very careful as well not to over-regulate the sector, over-supervise it, or have too many supervisors, you know, that firms don't know, like, you know, I have to report, you know, whether it's, is there a conflict between GDPR and the supervisory mechanisms that are in place, or, you know, we've got to really look at this very carefully, and we're doing that right now. In terms of the opportunity for financial services in Ireland, and it's enormous. I mean, I think this is an area, like, we see the changes in banking here. Just yesterday, you know, we had 80 local bank, you know, firms, not firms, branches, that it was announced Bank of Ireland were closing. You know, so the old model of going into the bank, and people would still like to see that, but actually there is a huge change from a cultural point of view. And that is just reflective of the digital space. We have, you know, Revolut, we have so many new financial firms and fintech services. But we've certainly grown it here in Ireland. I think there's a lot more potential. And I think in terms of, you know, businesses moving into the whole digital space, there's an incredible amount of work to do. And we really have to help business more. As I said earlier, small businesses are not doing enough of this at all. And I think we can help them. And it's going to be a very key area. Also, in terms of where, you know, businesses get their money from, in Europe, unlike America, it's from the banks as opposed to the capital markets. And so capital market union in the EU is a big goal. And on our economic committee, another issue I've been doing a lot of work on is anti-money laundering. I mean, the criminals are ahead of us. How do we manage this? There's huge money laundering when it comes to people trafficking, drugs and so on, right around our world. I mean, we're talking about billions in lost revenue. And I think we, at European level, what we're doing, Robert, is we're saying that the national approach isn't really working. We have to cooperate more across Europe. And of course, it's a global issue. And we have to link very closely with the criminal justice agencies as well, because it's an absolutely enormous issue in America and across Europe.
Do you think you'll be able to get that cooperation across Europe to act on, you know, developing the capital markets or to act on anti-money laundering legislation in practice?
There's a lot of resistances. You know, it's you can't take it for granted that you'll be able to do it, because it's this balance that you mentioned earlier, and I didn't reply to actually, about national competence and European competence. We see in health is a national competence. But actually, if you think about health issues, you can't deal with cancer as a country on your own, in my view. You can't do the kind of research. You can't sort out the innovation, the access to innovative drugs that you need to, because, you know, the costs are prohibitive for a start. So I think there's incredible scope. I think we're going to have to move towards even more complementarity, I would call it, between Europe and the member states. And I think there's a lot of scope there for us to do more on that. You asked me about resistances. Yes, there's always a to-ing and fro-ing on the national competence. People get worried about kind of the big EU that's going to take away our national competence. I don't worry about that myself. I think the EU is very complementary to what we do. It leads as well, of course. It's directive force change, it's regulations force change on member states. And let's face it, some member states are slow on some issues and others are ahead. And it tries to get that uniformity in there, which is so important, not uniformity for the sake of it, but because it sets a standard. I've always found the EU sets a very high standard, Robert, on whether you're talking now about the Green Deal, whether you're talking about, you know, digital services. I find that what the EU does is at a very high standard. The research is very good. I would say they're leaders in the world in many, many areas, including equality, actually.
It's interesting you bring up standards. You are a member of, you're a delegate for the committee that has responsibility for relations with China. And you're also an alternate for the committee that has responsibility for relations with the United States. So you have this, I think, interesting perspective about the way the European Union relates to these two massive superpowers. You know, the EU recently signed the Comprehensive Agreement on Investment, which has been controversial in some quarters about how that is going to be kind of rolled out and structured. The EU's relationship with China, you know, kind of going through the work that the committee has done. I know there's concerns around, you know, the Uyghur population or the security law in Hong Kong. You know, to what extent can the European Union lead globally, you know, through instruments like the Comprehensive Agreement on Investment with China? Or are there other mechanisms that you think would be better for the EU to pull to kind of ensure things, you know, to promote a green economy or to promote an innovative economy or promote inclusivity, you know, outside of the European Union?
Well, I think, I mean, let's take EU-China first. I mean, we've just signed this EU-China Investment Agreement. It's at a very early stage, let me say. It's interesting when you look to China, we kind of have this relationship with China where we, you know, we compete We cooperate and we confront. And that's the basis of our policy to China. I mean, we EU exports to China were 198 billion. Our imports are 362 billion. So, I mean, we trade with China, no question of it. But of course, the geopolitics at present between the United States, Europe, and China, I would say that Europe is trying to very much values the transatlantic relationship, no question of that. It also has a developing relationship with China, but becoming quite fraught around human rights issues. We even have an example here in Ireland of an Irishman, Richard O'Halloran, who's been detained in China for 2 years. He's four young children and a family in Ireland. Nothing, no criminal charge, nothing against him, but he can't leave. Now, you can't behave like that. And the question of human rights and this sort of raising of human rights, and yet at the same time, being concerned about human rights at the same time having a trade agreement, there's a lot of tension in that relationship. And the Parliament in particular is very concerned about those issues. Now, Europe wants to lead. I think I don't think we want to be absolutely, if you like, for want of a better word, dependent on either continent. We want to exist in our own right as a place that has values and that wants to live by those values of respect, of free press, of respect for human rights, and so on, and develop our businesses. We need to do more on innovation, no question, but we do want to play our role in the world on leading towards climate change and in peace and security. And it's very complex, especially when you come to very authoritarian leaders that we're seeing around the world at the moment. And we are trying to forge a role that develops those relationships, but takes account of European values. So I think we're at a very exciting time in terms of EU trans-American relationships. After all, the previous president was not a fan of the EU, quite the opposite. We now have a president in America who is interested in multilateralism, who cares about the kind of issues that are to the fore in Europe. And I think it's an exciting time. We've just published a document on how we can cooperate with America. I've mentioned some of the issues already on trade, on climate change, and so on, and on peace and security. So I think that, you know, it is challenging, no question. It's difficult. But, you know, we're a trading bloc, an important trading bloc. We have, 500 million people. It's a huge market for other countries. And we want to develop that and lead the way on the digital, on the green transformation, and indeed in the recovery from COVID.
How does Ireland kind of assert its voice in those European relationships with the United States and China? I mean, Ireland's done a very good job, in terms of the EU dialogue on Brexit, in terms of its own individual relationship with countries like the United States and indeed with China or India or other places around the world. I mean, but as the European Union works out what its relationship is going to be going forward with China and the United States and how it's going to lead on the global stage, how does the Irish voice come across in that?
Well, I think we have an extraordinary relationship with America. It's quite unique, I would say, in Europe. That 30 million people who, have connect to Ireland, 10% of your population. I mean, the level of connectedness that we've had over the years and, our St. Patrick's Day, the other countries really look at that, Robert, and they're very jealous of it. I have to say it's a fantastic link that we have to the United States, our diaspora. And I think Europe, the other countries in Europe are very conscious of that. And they're amazed at the access that we've always had over the years. And particularly now, of course, again, with the president, we hope and look forward to developing the relationship with President Biden. I had the pleasure of accompanying him when he was here on his visit some years ago to Carlingford. And I saw firsthand how he engages and relates with people. And I think Ireland has that important understanding of America. built up over generations. Politically and socially, culturally, those links are incredibly important to us. And I think we bring those with us into our dialogue in Europe about the EU relationship with America. So that very deep connection that's there, I think we speak to that in Europe all of the time and influence the debate in Europe. So when I'm in discussions in the EU-American delegation or the EU-China delegation, I bring that connectedness that I've had over the years with the USA to those discussions. And I think our leaders bring them very significantly into the discussions on trade. I think you saw when we had our commissioner who was Irish, you saw the very close work he was doing on the WTO with America and brought that understanding and that, you know, relationship that we have with America into play, actually, into those discussions. So I think we do that all of the time.
I think people here in the US are certainly feeling the lack of a traditional St. Patrick's Day this year, and I think most people will probably support you or attest to that cultural bind. So that's exciting to hear, and it's good to hear. There have been a couple questions that have come in since we've been speaking. One takes us back to the financial services area, and there's two people would like to know what the EU is doing with regard to the Bitcoin economy. I'm not sure if the Economic and Monetary Affairs Committee has taken up regulatory issues around Bitcoin.
No, I think it's an area that's, you know, going to become more and more central. It's at a very early stage, I have to say, and there really isn't agreement on how to go forward yet. We may be, in fact, a little bit slow about it, but it's very early stages, and I'm just not sure how that's going to develop, Robert. I'm not expert on it, and I couldn't actually give an answer to that I think, except to say that I believe we're at a very early stage in terms of regulation and, you know, deciding across Europe how we will handle. We've had some hearings, but that's it at this point.
That's good. There's a question that's come in on, and this relates to your role as Minister for Children and Youth Affairs. It's a question that's come in on, what is your view on the government's pronouncements regarding the right of survivors and victims of the mother and baby homes? That has, I think, been an issue of concern for the community here in Boston. I'm not sure if you have any thoughts on the discussions that are ongoing in Ireland on that.
Oh, well, I'm delighted to see that in our new diaspora strategy, that it's taking, I was speaking to Minister Brophy just recently about that, and that there's a particular effort within that to reach out to people who have emigrated, who may well have had that experience of institutional care in Ireland or forced adoptions or that whole area. I think it has been very important to give voice to the experience of people who have been in those institutions. And I think that I want to ensure in the future that the voices of those who were affected by this, that there is an ongoing opportunity for them to have voice, both in relation to government and in all of our strategies as far as government is concerned. I mean, I think we've done quite a bit in terms of trying to understand the scale of that experience. People have been shocked and horrified by it. I think I referenced earlier when we were talking about marriage equality that we've come from a very dark place in Ireland on many of these issues and how we've treated people who were seen as different. And obviously to have a baby outside marriage in Ireland was like the worst sin in the world. And I mean, it was extraordinary, the traumatic and dreadful experiences and the lack of human rights that people suffered. And it would be a long time before we would be able to make up to the people who had that experience and the current survivors. But I think that has to be the goal. And I know Minister Roderick O'Gorman is working on this. And we've had the commission. Some people want to the commission to continue. But my understanding is at this point is that it's finishing. But it doesn't mean the work is finished.
Okay, thank you. We began this conversation by talking about your motivation in politics and what keeps you going. And we talked a little bit about some of the successes you had, some of the challenges and setbacks you've had. And I think I'd like to end with you today on, you know, what are those leadership lessons that you have learned as a political leader all these years? And this is a topic that has consumed many books. Most of political theory is consumed by, you know, success and leadership in politics. But I mean, if you could sum it up in a few minutes, I mean, what have you learned through your career about, you know, managing success and setbacks and all the service that you've given to people of Ireland?
Well, look, I mean, what have I learned? I've learned that it's tough. I mean, I think it's tough leading, but it's a great privilege. I've learned that you have to find resilience in yourself. You have to get support. You do have to have friends. You have to have supportive friends and family. That's a great help, but it's tough. It can be very tough. I've been through some very tough experiences, and you know, it often hits you sideways. If you know it's not what you're expecting, it can be something totally unexpected that you don't have any control over. As you said, I've had I've had ups and downs. I think what helps is first of all resilience, support, good mentoring, places where you can think well. I think you need a good thinking environment where you can work things out. You have to take some time out to do that. I think what has supported me, I think, and what's kept me going through difficult times has been a sense that you're doing things that matter, that you're working from a values base. I mean, I think as a politician, you have to have, look at in life, you have to have a values base that informs you, that drives your work. And that kind of, when you know that you're doing that, and you don't always meet that. I mean, there are times when you look back and you say, God, I should have stuck with that. I should have fought on that issue, and I didn't, for varying reasons. But I think if you're working towards the basic values that you bring into politics, if you can hold on to those as strongly as you possibly can, then I think the satisfaction of the work helps you to cope with the disappointments. But, I think you do have to, you have to see yourself as an influencer, and you have to believe in influencing. And I think one's leadership, being honest, it can wax and wane. Not everybody is a brilliant leader all of the time. There's ups and downs in leadership as well. I think sometimes we expect too much of leaders. We don't allow for sort of, human frailties and the challenges that life poses. But, politics is very adversarial. I mean, I would like politics. I think there is room for a less adversarial politics. I have to say it would serve the citizens better. We also, of course, have unfinished democracies, as long as you don't have women better represented and a critical mass of women. The idea that in Ireland we still only have 22% of women in our parliament is outrageous. It's not that much better in the States. I mean, it's not good enough. I mean, how can you run a country when you just don't have the level of representation of 50% of the population? So, those kind of things have kept me going, working on those issues. And I think that leadership is about hard work. It's about consistency. It's about being very well briefed. Really, probably you have to work exceptionally hard and be happy to work extremely hard. But, that's life for the vast majority of people. So I don't think politics is that different to people who are running their own businesses, who are working in academia. It's just it is unfinished, though. I will say that it can be better.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it. Thank you, Francis, for taking a little over an hour of your life away here to chat about these things. As I said, when I started doing the research for this, I've forgotten just how expansive your career has been. There's just too much to cover. And the European Union is a beast as an institution onto itself. We can continue to talk about many more experiences in the parliament. So I want to thank you for your time today. I also encourage people to subscribe to your podcast. podcast, The European Lens. If you're interested in Irish and European issues, it's really it's fascinating, and the interviews you have, they're very, very interesting. They really dive deep into some areas. In particular, we had your colleague Minister Donoghue on in August of 2020 in this forum, and he's been to Boston College before. It was nice to hear him talking about tax in the European Union in a different format. So it's a great listen. So please do subscribe to it if you have a moment. Here at the GLI, you can continue to follow us on Twitter and our listserv. We'll have more discussions shortly. We'll be announcing those. So stay tuned for that. Again, thank you, Francis, for your time today. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Goodbye, everyone. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you for joining us today as we work to enhance Boston College's presence and impact in the world by building trust, community, and dialogue. Please visit our website at bc.edu for more information on today's speaker, and follow us on Twitter at GLIATBC, or find us on LinkedIn at Global Leadership Institute at Boston College.